It's a Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. True crime stories have always been popular, especially when they involve murder. But we're seeing something different in the way these stories are being told, with less of an emphasis on neatly timed presentations with tidy resolutions and more of a focus on the sausage-making reality of many courtrooms and police stations. Serialized true crime programs like The Making of a Murderer and the first season of the podcast Serial are bringing the dysfunction of due process into the spotlight. Joining us to talk about this recent phenomenon and our fascination with these criminal matters is David Harris, distinguished faculty scholar at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. He joins us in studio. David Harris, good to have you back with us.
Great to be with you again, Paul.
Also joining us in studio is Pittsburgh Post-Gazette court reporter Paula Reed Ward, who has covered 15 death penalty cases, including the Robert Ferrante trial. Her forthcoming book is called Death by Cyanide. It's due out this summer. Paula Reed Ward, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Paul. Thank you.
And with us by phone is State University of New York at Buffalo Professor David Schmid, who is the author of Violence in American Popular Culture. David Schmid, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much.
You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Let me start with David Schmid. Why is the American public so fascinated with these true crime stories, particularly when it comes to murder?
I think there's a variety of reasons. I think part of the answer is to do with fear. There's a lot of data that suggests that the public's level of fear about violent crime is much higher than the actual incidence of violent crime. And there's a variety of reasons for that. But I think true crime narratives give the American public one way of engaging with their fear about crime in a fairly manageable and predictable sense. And this is a good way for people to engage with the subject in a safe way.
David Harris, same question. Why are we so fascinated by violent crime stories and real-life murder investigations?
Well, Paul, everybody loves a good story. You have to start there. Beyond that, the stakes in a story about murder cannot be higher, just human being to human being. What could possibly be more important than one person taking the life of another? Then you add to it this new layer we're seeing now, which you commented on in your opening. We have effectively these stories exposing long hidden flaws in the justice system. We see how things go wrong. We see how the wrong people get blamed. And we're realizing through these gripping stories that this can happen. Certain things that we've always thought just couldn't be the case. Who would confess to something they didn't do? And yet we can see how these things might happen. All those sorts of errors are on display, so people are getting an extra something from these very good stories. They're seeing where our justice system is and how it really works.
And why were these flaws hidden for so long?
Well, they were always there. And if you worked in the system as I did, you did see these things. But it's only been in the last 20 to 30 years, really with the advent of DNA testing, that we have actually had to confront real cases in which we know for certain that people who were convicted, people who even confessed, people in cases when an eyewitness said, it's definitely that guy, I'll never forget his face, people in cases like that were innocent. And that has caused a sea change in public thinking. Now, it's been slower, I think, than a lot of people would have anticipated. I mean, DNA is not new. Those cases have been in the news for 25 years. We're all sort of vaguely aware of it. But these documentaries, things like Serial or the Making a Murderer series, these bring it right up close to you so you can see those flaws, and they become very hard to ignore in the context of a real story of a real case.
So these were things we might have known about in the past, but and we might have known, or there probably were people who knew that people were being wrongly accused or falsely convicted, and yet there wasn't the DNA to prove it like we have now.
Correct. And it's in that last 25 years that we've slowly been confronting this.
Which television treatments of this topic would you say are best?
Well, for me, I'm just starting this Making a Murderer series. I find it fascinating. Television in general has been more about based on a true story or ripped from the headlines. It has been less about true crime. The Jinx series on the HBO channel I thought was pretty good, that about Robert Durst, the wealthy guy who was accused in several murders. And I, you know, I know you're not talking about you're talking about television, but Serial, the podcast,
right.
I thought was brilliant on all of these issues, really exposing what actually happened in a deep, deep dive into one case.
So a lot of what we were getting, because I guess the difference is this: looking into, when you say the deep dive, the flaws, the problems with our criminal justice system, which maybe we, as Americans, or the networks, you know, in their sanitized versions of things, like I remember as a kid, the FBI, the true story out of the files. But, you know, J. Edgar Hoover was presiding over this. So
well,
who
right.
knows what was true?
Right. That stuff was just stories based on FBI kind of PR. Something closer
right.
might have been Law and Order. You could recognize certain storylines.
That was much later.
Yeah, it was much, much later. But even that, you know, I have people come into my classroom all the time, and that, you know, they've watched hours and hours of that stuff. And one of the things that I tell my students is, you've learned a lot of law and a lot about the legal system. Here's the bad news. You have to unlearn all of it. I got to teach you what's really going on, because television in general has not been accurate. It sanitizes things. It oversimplifies things. It's drama. That's what it is. You couldn't expect anything else. These sorts of programs, like Making a Murderer, really take it to an entirely different level.
David Schmidt, what are the things that you're gravitating toward?
I would repeat David's enthusiasm for Serial and Making a Murderer. And I would also point out that part of the difference here is moving away from a network-based model of crime programming to something that, you know, allows for much larger and more complex narratives to be told. Because, as you said, Paul, at the start of the program, there has been a tendency in true crime programming to look for that needy, that neat, a tidy resolution. And I think what we're seeing here with these more recent narratives is a greater attention to complexity, a willingness to acknowledge that there are loose ends, that there are ambiguities that perhaps can never be resolved. And the other thing I would point out is that when the Serial program blew up, no one was more surprised than the people who were making that program. I don't think anyone anticipated that it would touch a public nerve in the way that it did. And I think you can say the same thing about Making a Murderer to a certain extent. And I think what that points to is that the network certainly did not feel that there was really much audience interest in critical representations of law enforcement. But what we're getting now is we're seeing evidence that there really is an audience for that kind of program. And I think part of the reason for that is because the audience wants to feel not only that these problems are being exposed and acknowledged and treated, but also that the audience themselves can have some form of participation in making things better. And I think this is part of the reason why Making a Murderer is so successful, because with the petition drive, for example, to have Stephen Avery's case either reexamined or for him to be pardoned, it gives the audience a way of both acknowledging that something is wrong and participating in an attempt to fix it. And that's really new territory for true crime.
And Serial did not solve the 1999 murder case that it exhaustively explored. Why wouldn't Americans want a satisfying finale that answers all their questions? I'll throw that up to anybody here. Paula Reed Ward.
I think that one of the reasons is that society, people recognize that things cannot be solved. Everything is not a black and white situation. There
You're
are
telling
so many
me that in 1 hour we can't sift through all that DNA evidence and the crime scene evidence, and in 1 hour, you know, 48 minutes actually minus the 12 minutes of commercial, we can't wrap that up in that time?
Listen, we try. As reporters, we try. As storytellers, we try. But, you know, in the real world, that doesn't happen. And so I think that when you hear a compelling story and you hear all sides of it, that gives people more than just everything wrapped up in a pretty little package.
And earlier this month, Lisa Kern Griffin wrote about the real contribution of these documentaries. being not to ask who done it, but to reveal what was done to the defendants. What about that?
I think court system should always be under review by society, because there are so many ways that bad things can happen, whether purposefully, you know, like in Making a Murderer, perhaps, or inadvertently, when 25 years ago there wasn't DNA to tie somebody to a crime, but maybe there was flawed eyewitness testimony. So when you look at those elements that exist, we have to recognize that the entire process needs to be under review from start to finish, from the police department through the attorneys that represent people, the prosecution, public defenders, all the way up to the judges.
It's so true. You know, we are accustomed to hearing about a few cases, well, whether it's Bill Cosby or other celebrities, people, you know, or disastrous, terrible murders, things like that. The vast majority of what goes on in the criminal justice system involves poor people, folks who have no media attraction whatsoever. It's every day. It's all the time. Most of it is handled by plea bargains, not dramatic trials. So whatever can be done to bring more light to a process that most Americans will have no experience with and pay no attention to and simply understand through the myths of the 48-hour easily resolved case in which justice always prevail, whatever can break through that, I think, is a net plus. I'll say our system doesn't work perfectly. It works as the best that human beings perhaps can make it work, but it can work better. And to the extent we know that it has flaws and those flaws get exposed, that's the first step, certainly, in getting to some better resolutions with how we handle these issues.
And later on in this discussion, I want to get into things like what does the U.S. criminal justice system really need? But you were talking, David, about, and there are cases that happen every day involving people that society would not necessarily think of as people of note, and they're lower profile cases that really kind of go under the radar. Certain cases end up drawing a lot of attention, and Paula Reed Ward, you covered a big one here in Pittsburgh, the trial of Dr. Robert Ferrante, the University of Pittsburgh researcher convicted of poisoning his wife with cyanide. When he was on trial, it made front page screaming headlines on a daily basis, right up to where he was found guilty. And I can't remember which paper it was, but guilty was like a huge headline that took up half of the front page. Why did this case hold so much fascination for people?
I think part of the reason for sure is that they were relatable to society. So much we hear about drug-related crimes and, you know, shootings on the street, which are equally as important for sure. But in a case where you have a poisoning, it's unusual. People don't generally poison each other. Adding to those circumstances, you have two affluent white people. They have professional positions. They had what appeared from the outside a very good marriage. They lived in a really great house. You know, they were very well educated. When you add all those things together, a homicide, a cyanide poisoning, is completely unusual and out of the question. And who would think that these people who had such a seemingly great life would fall to this human condition?
And this was made into a television show, and you've written a book about it, Death by Cyanide, which is coming out this summer. And you were originally approached about appearing in the television show. I guess 48 Hours and Dateline were in a battle over who was going to bring this to television. And tell us about, you know, Dateline won, and they were the ones who brought it to television. Tell us about, you know, why there was so much interest in this and what finally happened.
With the television programming as it was, you know, again, you had these two very interesting characters. Adding to the drama of the story, the couple, Ferrante and Autumn Klein, had a young daughter. The young daughter went to live with her maternal grandparents, who are in their early 80s. So you add an extra layer of sadness and tragedy to what this story is. In addition to that, you have Ferrante, who has two adult children who were battling for custody of their younger half-sister. So you add in all those different layers of human drama and tragedy, and I think it's perfect for a made-for-TV kind of movie or program. And Dateline had a connection with Mrs. Klein, with Lois Klein, Autumn's mother, and she went with them, and they did an hour-long feature on it back in the early spring.
you know, at the risk of putting you on the spot, what did you think of how it turned out?
I thought that I think that it ended abruptly. It seemed like everybody expected it to maybe be a 2-hour long program, and it was really only an hour. And I think that they missed...
Back to that 1-hour formula thing.
It was. Everything had to be wrapped up very quickly. I thought that it, because it was as short as it was and the story was as complex as it was, that it missed a lot of opportunity that it could have grabbed to make the story more dramatic.
David Schmid, do you think part of our fascination with true crime stories is how we relate to the people involved, that they could be our neighbors, or that we, in the case of the one we just discussed, the Ferrante case, that, you know, maybe we like to see wealthy people have problems too?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of what's going on here. I mean, I think there are all kinds of factors that come into what makes a particular case mediagenic, either to television or to journalists or to the true crime genre. And in that respect, I would say that programs like Serial and Making a Murderer definitely represent an advance in the genre. But we should also recognize that we've got a long way to go. I think in some ways the recent surge in true crime is related to and a product of, say, in post-Ferguson and also of post-Trayvon Martin, the Black Lives Matter movement, so on and so forth. In other words, I think it's relevant to sort of consider the context of race in true crime narratives, because that's one of the factors that leads people to feel that a case is, quote-unquote, relatable or not relatable. To put it bluntly, Michael Brown is not going to be getting his program, his true crime special. Trayvon Martin is not going to be getting a true crime special. So I think there are patterns in which cases tend to receive the most attention. And, you know, as we all know, the last few days, the hashtag OscarsSoWhite has been getting a lot of press and a lot of traction. I think to some extent, you could also have the hashtag TrueCrimeSoWhite, because there is definitely a pattern that only certain kinds of cases are deemed worthy of serious and extensive coverage.
Wry smiles breaking out in the studio, people recognizing exactly the point that you're making, David Schmid. David Harris, your thoughts?
I think David is exactly right. Certain cases attract attention. How many times, I mean, I'll zero in on one television program, particularly the program hosted by a certain former prosecutor named Nancy Grace. How many young white women do we know about their murder cases, their disappearances, and so forth? And what else does she cover? Would there be a Nancy Grace program without those kinds of cases? She's just one example of how the media looks at certain victims and seems to value them because they are telegenic. And that does not reflect the reality of homicide in our country or even in our city of Pittsburgh.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about true crime stories, particularly murder cases, why we are so fascinated with them, and why media has such a fascination. Also about the new wave of serialized true crime programs like The Making of a Murderer and the first season of the podcast Serial, and the impact they are having as they bring the dysfunction of due process into the spotlight. We'll continue our conversation with our guests, Pitt Law Professor David Harris, also Paula Reed Ward of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and David Schmid with the State University of New York in Buffalo. And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about true crime stories. They've always been popular, especially when they involve murder. And the new wave, the new ways in which these stories are being told, with less of an emphasis on neatly timed presentations, with tidy resolutions, and more of a focus on the dysfunction in courtrooms and police stations. We're hearing more and more about this and serialized true crime programs like The Making of a Murderer and the first season of the podcast Serial. And we're talking about this with David Harris, who is Distinguished Faculty Scholar at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. Also, Paula Reed Ward, who has covered 15 death penalty cases, including the Robert Ferrante trial. Her forthcoming book about that trial is coming out this summer. It's called Death by Cyanide. And with us by phone is State University of New York at Buffalo Professor David Schmid, author of Violence in American Culture. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. Let's go to our first caller, Ted in Mount Washington. Hi, Ted. You're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, sir.
Hey, real quick, I'd like to know, what's the impact of cameras in the courtroom? I can remember the O.J. case, how, you know, the judge, you know, he looked like he wanted to be a movie star, and yet...
Judge Ito, Lance Ito? Lance Ito, right?
That's right.
Yes, yes, yes. He was more concerned about a movie being made by him. And, you know, I mean, and even when you see policemen when they're in the courtroom when the camera's on them, what impact is that to regular society?
You know, Ted, that's a great question. And, David, you know, if you are being cross-examined and, you know, it's already I'll start with David Harris. You're being cross-examined in a courtroom. You've been in your share of courtrooms. You know, that's nerve-wracking enough, let alone having a camera zooming in on you and it's everybody in the world is watching. Paul, and Paula, you can chime in too.
Well, it's true, Paul. It can be a distorting influence, as Ted says, on the justice system and on any particular trial. What would determine whether that happens, however, is how or whether a judge controls it. These days, the equipment itself is not intrusive anymore. So there wouldn't be cameras in the courtroom in the sense that you would notice them. And we can do things like pixelating faces and so forth, that the technology that wasn't available a long time ago. I think the impact of some of these trials in the past, particularly, though not only, the O.J. Simpson case, was so disastrous for courtroom proceedings. It sort of took over and made it a circus to such an extent that you now still, 20 years later, have many courts saying no cameras. Where I think in a lot of cases it wouldn't change anything, and certainly judges would be much more willing to control how things went in ways that we saw go wrong in some of those televised trials. So it could be done now in ways that I think would not disturb the process as much. But let's face it, the important thing is not whether it's on television. The important thing is whether the trial goes well and fairly. So if we have to make a choice, that's the obvious choice.
Prior to moving back to Pittsburgh, where I'm originally from, I had covered the court system in Savannah, Georgia, where cameras were allowed in the courtroom. And I've been in several different situations. And generally, the cameras can be hidden behind a window in the wall. There aren't 35 cameras like in the O.J. Simpson trial.
That's
where
right.
You could hear everything and it was such a giant conglomeration. They can be subdued, and people don't even have to know that they're there.
But
and I think that what cameras can do is add a layer of accountability to the system.
Yes,
absolutely. Since the O.J. Simpson trial, Pennsylvania, even in the last year or two, have passed rules that not only are there no cameras anywhere outside of a hallway in the courthouse, you're not even allowed to have cell phones in the courtrooms now, or laptop computers, or anything else. We have gone in Pennsylvania backwards from the trend of openness and transparency.
And that having been said, and Paula, that's a very important point. But even if the cameras aren't obtrusive and clunky, you know, you think back to the things like the Army McCarthy hearings, where you know they've got these giant, you know, tube cameras and the lights and it's impossible not to notice. But even when you don't notice them, you know they're there. You know you're on television. And back to Ted's point about Lance Ito, a judge who's playing to the cameras, it's affecting justice, isn't it?
I don't think that it has to be.
But
you can have a judge playing to the camera or to the media without the cameras being in the courtroom, based on the things that they say, the way that they say them, specifically addressing the media. That happens whether the cameras are in the courtroom or not. They they can be a distraction when they are big and bulky in the courtroom. But generally, after the first day of a trial, especially a high-profile trial, everybody comes to accept that they're part of the fixtures. That's just the way they are. And I think that most people go about and do their jobs the way they ought to.
And one little difference I have with what Ted said, Judge Ito, I know I remember hearing stories about how he was so enamored of what he was seeing in his in the coverage of himself. But honestly, his bigger problem was not playing to the cameras. It was playing to the lawyers. He cared about what Johnny Cochran and the rest of those people thought about him. And when you are in that position as a judge, you have lost control. I saw it.
The O.J. Simpson case is the subject of an upcoming TV movie, and in a recent Reuters article, it was singled out for the number of issues it addressed, including race, celebrity, sports, etc. David Schmid, what about that?
Yeah, I think with the O.J. case, the reason it continues to exert so much fascination over the American public is because it represents the confluence of a lot of the different things that we've been talking about. Not just cameras in the courtroom, but more generally, the notion that a trial is a dramatic spectacle and can be presented in that way and made mediagenic. So, you know, I think in the best case scenario, yes, you have accountability, yes, you have transparency, but there's a lot of worst case scenario out there as well. It's not just grandstanding. There's also the tendency where visibility becomes the kind of standard for what cases get told and how they get told. And popular culture as a whole has never been very good at analyzing the structural dimensions of violence. And I think this tendency to prioritize visibility over everything else that the O.J. Simpson trial really exemplified has potentially very damaging effects, again, on what kind of stories get told and what kind of stories tend to be left behind.
Let's go to George in Washington County at 412-246-2002. George, did we lose George? No, George. Okay. He says our fascination with true crime is nothing new. Certainly it isn't. Paula, there was a case that you covered in addition to the, well, you covered another high-profile case, not as big as the Ferrante case, but the Ken Konias trial. This was an individual. I'll let you explain. His job was to guard the contents of an armored car, and there was an interesting sort of fascination that the public had with this story. And I'll let you speculate about what it may have been. But tell us about the case first.
The case, Ken Konias was an employee of a local armored car service, and he had a partner, and they would go to local stores and banks and that kind of thing and pick up money, make deposits, that type of thing. He was accused of basically executing his partner in the back of the armored truck one day and stealing millions of dollars out of the back of the truck. And one of the things, I think there were a lot of elements that made that case fascinating, besides the fact that there was a manhunt for him for several weeks before they found him. In addition to that, you know, he was a young man. He took the money. He went to Florida. He spent the money on improper things like, you know, prostitutes and drugs and all those kinds of things before he was eventually arrested. So it was one of those tales of, you know, a guy steals all this money. In traditional lore, armored car heists were kind of honored, not for killing people. The great success stories are the ones where they steal the money and they get away, and they're kind of like heroes that they've stolen millions of dollars without harming anyone.
Hey, yeah, there's two guys sitting by the side of the road in an empty car that looked like Laurel and Hardy by the time it's over, and doesn't meet with such a tragic end. But is there sort of this, you know, and I'll let either of you chime in on this, but is there sort of like a biblical attraction to something, a story like this? It's the classic temptation. Here's the money. It's all right here. All I got to do is just get rid of the one guy who would know, and I can take the money. And it's probably something that crosses the mind of more people than we would care to think about, but they don't do it. But here's this Ken Konias acting on it. And giving into the darkest sides of ourselves that we all have to acknowledge are there, right?
Absolutely. He did. He crossed a line that most of us, whether it ever occurs to us in a moment of fantasy or not, we would never do that. And it's the reason that we don't punish people for having bad thoughts. Everybody has those, but very few of us would cross a line like this. And he did. And that makes this an object of fascination, though he wasn't a very adept criminal, as I remember the case. As Paula was saying, he left all kinds of breadcrumbs, was not that hard to track down, and it was just a terrible, cruel act from the basest human instincts.
But David Schmidt, is that why a story like this gets so much attention? Because it led the television news. It was front page news in the newspapers. You know, Paula's here grinding away, covering that trial, because people want to read about this. Does this speak again to this sort of this idea of the relatable thing that, you know, where somebody's sitting back reading this going, ooh, I've thought about doing something like that once. Thank God I didn't.
I think that's entirely possible. In fact, based upon what you were saying just a moment ago, Paul, it's one should note that, you know, this American fascination with crime goes all the way back to the Puritan era. I mean, some of the largest public gatherings in Puritan times were for executions, public executions. And the ministers during that time took the opportunity to instruct the crowd about exactly what they were seeing and how they should interpret it. And the residue of that kind of morality, you can see that today in contemporary true crime narratives. And I think one of the biggest reasons for the continued attraction of this kind of narrative is because they are so well-suited for teaching lessons to the audience. Now, the makers of these narratives today don't spell out the lessons as dogmatically as Puritan ministers did, obviously, but I still think that true crime can have a really important pedagogical function, and that is the root of our interest in these narratives, the lessons we're meant to draw from them, whether it be "there but for the grace of God go I," or, you know, "crime will always go punished," or whatever it happens to be. The lessons may be articulated explicitly or more implicitly, but they're always there, and I think that that's a big reason why we're attracted to these stories.
Karen, in an email, asks, how likely is it that the Wolf Sisters trial, scheduled to begin soon, will get extensive coverage since the characters are interesting? Paula?
I believe that the trial is scheduled for jury selection in mid to late February and is expected to start in early March, and it will get likely the same type of coverage that the Ferrante case and the Conius case got because of who the victims were in that case. One of them was a psychiatrist at, I think, Children's Hospital. I apologize for not knowing the details specifically. It's been a while since I looked at the case. And her sister, who worked as an educator at a local school. You had two sisters. They came from a large, good family. They lived together, and they were killed. And again, that is something that is relatable to society. And they were killed in a terribly brutal way. There was a lot of concern in the community that an arrest wasn't made immediately, so everybody was fearful in the community that this person is still out there, and what if he's a serial killer? And those are the kinds of concerns that people have, and that's what makes these stories attract media attention.
And getting back to the Ferrante trial, I don't know if we covered this, but last fall there was some new evidence that came out that might have exonerated him.
Not exactly. There's not new evidence per se. The defense is working on an appeal, and they're going to ask that they be permitted to do additional testing to see if it was possible that the cyanide test result, the positive cyanide result that they got on Autumn Klein's blood, to see if that was in fact a false positive and that she didn't die from cyanide poisoning at all. It's a long shot, to be fair, in terms of the appeal process.
All right. So looking at what is to be learned from the emphasis on today's true crime stories and looking at the process and the flaws in the process, it raises a lot of interesting questions, one of which is, what does the criminal justice system need going forward? David Harris.
Well, for me, Paul, it would improve things a lot if all of the players in the system, but especially the police and the prosecutors, were more open to what science can already tell them. We have a lot of science, well-established, 10, 20, even 30 years worth, on things like eyewitness identification, like the techniques used to interrogate people and how they produce occasional false confessions, like ways in which basic sorts of forensics, not DNA, but more basic things, need to have scientific underpinnings so we're not constantly discovering flaws in these things. If we would pay attention to what we actually already know, where there's strong scientific consensus, instead of denying it and saying that, you know, our system works just fine, look at how great it is, we could improve things a lot. The sausage-making process will always be flawed because it's run by human beings. It can't be perfect, and nobody's looking for that. But if we would just look at what we can do better right now based on what we know, I think we could go a long way to improving the system.
David Schmidt, will there be greater procedural integrity, do you think, because of what we're seeing, the type of docudramas that we're seeing now and hearing?
That's an interesting question. I do think it's always helpful when you know that you're being watched. It makes you want to do a better job. And hopefully this new trend in true crime will lead to greater accountability. But I have a sneaking suspicion that there were always going to be those stories out there. And I think coming at it from the point of view of a scholar of media and popular culture, I think one of the things that needs to happen is that true crime needs to continue to push the envelope. It needs to continue to be willing to explore the kinds of crimes, the kinds of situations that perhaps traditionally it has not done, so that we can have sustained attention paid to a much wider variety of crimes than true crime has typically been focused on in the past.
I'd like to chime in just real quickly. Sure. To a point that David Harris made in terms of the forensic reliability and science that has made crime solving so much better. There's an opposite side to that, which has been problematic recently in the courts as well, which is that every jury expects that there's going to be DNA evidence or fingerprint evidence or some other kind of scientific evidence that directly physically links the defendant to a crime. And there have been cases of late in Allegheny County and across the state where defendants have been found not guilty, even though there's great circumstantial evidence or eyewitness tests and things like that, because there has not been physical DNA or something else that ties the person to the crime.
Yes, we call this the CSI effect.
That's
people
right.
See it in crime dramas and they expect real life to work like that, and it just doesn't.
That's right.
We'll let Jen on Twitter have the last word. She says, I think there's a stranger than fiction element. If these were stories, fictional stories, they'd be fine. But as reality, terrifying and fascinating, she says. Well, it's been an interesting conversation, to say the least. I want to thank all of you for joining us. The frequent guest on this program, David Harris, who is a distinguished faculty scholar at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. And he joined us again in studio. Also, Paula Reed Ward, who has covered 15 death penalty cases, including the Robert Ferrante trial. Her forthcoming book is called Death by Cyanide. And David Schmid, who is a professor at State University of New York at Buffalo and author of Violence in American Popular Culture. Folks, thank you all for joining us. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Paul.
Thank you.
Coming up, a conversation with the reporters behind the WESA Public Source series, The Aftermath of Murder, on unsolved African American homicides. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.